My name is Dan Spencer, and this is the fifth in our series focusing on the church in Central America. Today's session is Nicaragua, A Church Responds to Revolution. And what I'd like to do today is to do very much the same pattern that we've done all week, and try and set some historical context for understanding how the church is responding today. So I put up an outline here that I'm going to accompany with slides and commentary to look at the dynamics within the church in Nicaragua today, starting with a brief background on Nicaragua, then looking at Nicaragua briefly under the Somoza dictatorship, which ruled Nicaragua for 45 years until it was overthrown in 1979. I'll look at the change within the church, particularly during the last years of the Somoza dictatorship, and then the insurrection that took place in 1978 and 79, and the response of Christians to this insurrection. Look then at some of the initial achievements of the revolution and the response of the church to this, and then the effects of the Contra War in the last few years on Nicaragua. And after that, then we'll have time for questions and discussion. So I think with that outline, we'll get started. I got someone flip the lights off in the back there. You may need to shift around a little bit. This is the map I wish I had last night, but this is Central America. Nicaragua is the largest country in Central America, the one that's shaped like a triangle right in the center. Oh, yeah, it should
back by the hallway here.
I think, or turn it. It turns out right behind the easel over there. Someone can just go over by the buffet. There's a light switch there. Okay, how are we doing now? Okay. Maybe the slide may not be this. This will give you an idea, though, where the location is. The little country here is El Salvador, as we talked about last night, and then this triangular-shaped country is Nicaragua, about five times the size of El Salvador. This is a closer look at Nicaragua. Nicaragua can geographically can be divided into three geographic zones. This over here is a close-up of the volcano area here, but it's bordered out by the Pacific Ocean on the west and the Caribbean Sea on the east coast. The broad band of on the west side here is the coastal plain of Nicaragua, and it's characterized by very broad, fertile soil and a large chain of volcanoes. This is where much of the agriculture, such as cotton, is grown. Then you have a large mountainous belt that runs down the center of the country, where much of the war is taking place because it's very good territory for guerrilla-type strategy and warfare. It's also the prime coffee-growing region in Nicaragua, which is the main crop for Nicaragua's export economy. And then finally, nearly half of the country is made up of the eastern coast of the Atlantic coast. And while it is made up about half the national territory, less than 10% of the people live here. Just some slides illustrate some of this. Nicaragua is known as the land of lakes and volcanoes. It has two very large lakes in it. One of them is characterized by having freshwater sharks, among other things, but also a large chain of volcanoes that run the length of the country along the Atlantic coast. So I mentioned the Pacific coast is characterized by broad, flat coastal plain with very rich agriculture, and then a large chain of volcanoes that run through the midst of this. And cotton is one of the major export crops in Nicaragua. The central part of the country, as I mentioned, is very mountainous. This is up near the city of Matagalpa, which we'll return to later. But this is the primary coffee-growing region of the country. And finally, the eastern part of Nicaragua, which originally was a British colony rather than Spanish, is where the Miskito Indians and the Black Caribbean Nicaraguans live. It's very, very different from the rest of the country. The style is a Caribbean style. People are ethnically derived either from the original Indian people in the region or from Black Carib people. And the primary languages are English and Miskito rather than Spanish. But we'll be focusing most of our talk today on the western part of the country, the Spanish speaking, because this is the part of the country that's been dominant politically and is engaged in the whole revolution today. Just by way of brief background, Nicaragua shows many of the dynamics within the church that we've talked about earlier. Traditionally a very religious people, and among the majority of the people, their religion has been expressed culturally through festivals at the different patron saint feast occasions. This is the Way of the Cross here, which is conducted every Friday during Lent. And also focusing a lot around the celebration of the Virgin Mary, who is a very important figure in Catholic religion, particularly in Nicaragua. This is a picture of the cathedral in downtown Managua, which was destroyed during the earthquake in 1972. And I think it's a good metaphor for understanding what is happening to the church in Nicaragua, because the church in the last 15 years has been shaken to its very foundations by the insurrection and overthrow of the Somoza dictatorship and by the ensuing Sandinista revolution, and is constantly being challenged to respond to these events. Just some brief background about Nicaragua during the Somoza regime. At the time the Somoza family was overthrown in 1979, President Anastasio Somoza was the third of three Somozas who had ruled Nicaragua for 45 years. And he was an extremely wealthy man, wealth in the billions of dollars. He owned the 26 largest companies in Nicaragua and owned over one-fifth of the total country's land mass, including the best agricultural lands. The rest of Nicaragua, however, was characterized by extreme poverty. Nicaragua, along with Honduras, were the two poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti. The health situation in Nicaragua was abysmal. There, very few people had access to health care, and the living conditions oftentimes meant no access to drinkable water. And during the rainy seasons in particular, diseases ran rampant. The infant mortality rate was around 200 children dying out of every 1,000 born, as opposed to 13 or 14 in the United States. This is a typical scene in the Nicaraguan countryside, traditionally and still today, of the one water source being used for everything from drinking water to bathing to washing clothing. I mentioned that Nicaragua's economy is built around export crops. This particularly developed in this century and through the 30s, 40s, and 50s as it became a very profitable way for the economic elite in Nicaragua, and primarily the Somoza family, to gain tremendous wealth at the expense of the rest of Nicaraguans. The economy is built primarily around coffee, and this is a coffee farm in Nicaragua. Many of you saw or may have seen Nancy Rebecca's presentation on the coffee experience she had in January. But one of the things that characterized the coffee industry was extreme brutality among the workers. And if you look in the background there, you see a number of little houses up on the slope. Those are new homes that have been built for the laborers since the revolution. But for the 30 or 40 years before that, all of the coffee workers lived in these large barns with their families. And each family was given one cubicle, such as this, that measure 4 feet by 4 feet by 6 feet. And so you may have had 6 or 10 people living in each one of these cubicles while they worked on the coffee plantation. The thing that allowed the Somoza dictatorship to stay in power was a very powerful National Guard, which was noted for its brutal repression against the people. And this is the remnants of one of the National Guard prisons up in León, Nicaragua, that was destroyed during the fighting in the war. The National Guard used political persecution and repression to keep down dissent in Nicaragua and to keep the poor and the working class from organizing themselves to demand their rights. This is one of the prison cells in this prison in León. I put this in here too because this is a representative of a very typical relationship between the older, more traditional style of the church. This was the chapel at the prison in Leon, where the prison guards would come to seek forgiveness or do confession and seek penance after torturing political prisoners. And there was a Catholic chaplain there that then would grant forgiveness to them. Very close alliance between the older style of the church and the military has typified much of Latin America. What has started to emerge, as I mentioned, is a new style of church. And this began to emerge primarily in the 1970s, when a number of the priests began to work with the poor, and in particular in this church, which is a newer building, but this parish in a working-class neighborhood in Managua, began to form small base communities among the people. And a number of university students became increasingly concerned with the situation of the country, and so they left some of their studies and moved into this church and began working with the working class neighborhood here and reflecting on the scriptures, trying to learn what God was willing during these times and what they could be doing about it. And interesting about the thing about that is a number of them eventually decided that the situation was so dramatic in Nicaragua that they had to join the armed opposition, the Sandinista Front for National Liberation. And so many of the Christians came out of this church, joined the armed insurrection, and today a number of the leaders of the country are people who first began in the base communities in this church and churches similar to this. Part of the influence was a number of foreign priests who were in Nicaragua as missionaries and came to Nicaragua without the centuries of traditional church understanding that had built up in Latin America. They came having been commissioned by the theology that was developed in Vatican II, with the church being re-injected into the lives of the people. And they began to work with the people at all levels in Nicaraguan society to work for change. One of the things that has come out of this then is a whole re-articulation and re-examining of their faith in light of their own lives. And so you see a real cultural and artistic explosion in Nicaragua where people through poetry, through painting, through music and songs are talking and reflecting on their faith but out of their own experience. One example here is the Campesino Christ, a picture of Christ carrying the cross, but Christ is a Nicaraguan campesino or peasant. In the church, you see the murals then, and here is the working class Christ who is being resurrected from the cross with the people there at the foot of the cross. And they took similar scenes such as the women at the foot of the cross and put their own situation in that. One of the things that is typified, many of the countries in Central America have been groups of mothers who have organized after their children have been killed or disappeared. And you'll see them protesting or marching in the streets holding photographs of their lost children. In the video last night, they showed the Committee of Mothers in El Salvador. Nicaragua had a similar committee of mothers. And so this now, the women at the foot of the cross, they reflect on their own situation of their own children being killed for working for some social change. One of the main source of inspiration probably for the Sandinista insurrection that developed during the 1960s and 1970s was a man named Augusto Sandino, who led a peasant army in the 1920s against the occupation of U.S. Marines in Nicaragua. The United States occupied Nicaragua with Marines from 1912 to 1933, and the latter 7 or 8 years, from 1926 or so on, this man, Sandino, organized a peasant army to expel the Marines. When the Marines finally were withdrawn by President Roosevelt in 1933, they had in the meantime organized a National Guard to take their place and had put at its helm a man named Somoza. Somoza then invited Sandino to a peace banquet to celebrate the exit of the Marines and had Sandino assassinated. But his memory continued within the lives of the people, even though there was tremendous repression in the intervening years. And so when an opposition movement began to develop to the Somoza government, they took the name of Sandino as their inspiration, much as the way we see Washington as the founder of our country. And then Sandino became Sandinista, meaning followers of Sandino, in the insurrection that developed. This insurrection remained very, very small during the 1960s and 70s, probably no more than 100 guerrillas at any one time, and oftentimes far fewer than that. But during the 1970s, there was a number of different events that caused it to grow tremendously, leading to a popular insurrection. One of these was a tremendous earthquake that destroyed Managua in 1972. And some of you may, or many of you may remember this because there was a tremendous outpouring of international aid. In fact, if some of you know the baseball player Roberto Clemente of Pittsburgh Pirates, he was killed when his plane taking goods down to Managua crashed, but he was involved in the relief efforts. Well, Somoza used the earthquake as a further way of enriching himself, and this further alienated him from all classes in Nicaragua, and for the first time, even the wealthy business class became opposed to his rule. He channeled all of the international aid through his own offices, and it took things such as the food that was coming in and had it sold to the people who had been left homeless. There were about 15,000 people killed in the earthquake and over 100,000 who were left homeless. And testimony of this is not the earth, this is not Managua after the earthquake. This is Managua about 2 years ago, 14 years after the earthquake. The city was never rebuilt, simply left abandoned, and Somoza became increasingly wealthier as a result of this. One of the things that began to happen was that Christians were forced now to make a decision about what their participation was going to be. The situation in Nicaragua was getting worse and worse. The political repression was increasing. And so you begin to see signs of Christians for the first time beginning to take place in an effort to overthrow the Somoza government. This is a piece of graffiti from one of the prison cells, and the FSLN stands for the Sandinista Front for National Liberation, which was a broad-based armed opposition movement that eventually succeeded in overthrowing the Somoza government. But right above it there, you see the crucifix, and I think it was representative of the kind of reflection and struggle that was going on among many Christians about how they respond to the increasing oppression in Nicaragua. And many Christians did choose than to take up arms against the Somoza government. Many other Christians did not feel that they could, as Christians, take up arms, but worked in other ways to help overthrow the Somoza government. In 1978, then, there was an initial attempt at insurrection, and the headline here says, Violence in Five Cities, and lists the five cities on the right side. This was crushed by the National Guard, and in the insurrection, the 2 or 3 years leading up to the triumph of the revolution in 1979, over 40,000 people were killed by the National Guard, primarily civilians. Few of those were actually combatants. Most of those were civilians. To give you an idea, Nicaragua has a population of about 3 million people, which means about 1 out of every 75 people were killed during those 2 years. Nearly everyone knew someone who had been killed during that time. I put this person in here. The woman in the center is named Carmen, and she is a woman from a wealthy family in León who nevertheless began to see what she considered the wrongness of the Somoza government. And so she declared her house a safe house for the guerrillas who were fighting against it, and which meant that the guerrillas, when they came into León, knew that they could come to her house and gain, be harbored there in safety until they left the town. So when they were wounded, they would come in. When they needed supplies, they would come in. And Carmen would house them. Carmen talks herself about not being able to participate in the violence directly, but feeling very called to overthrow the evil of the Somoza government. This picture here is of her back bedroom. And she talks about one time when she was harboring 6 Sandinista guerrillas in this bedroom. And the National Guard came onto the roof of her house and were starting to fire down in through the roof and demanding that she come out and surrender. And they were going all along the block doing this to several houses, suspecting that there were Sandinistas nearby. The 6 young guerrillas said that they, or told her that they needed to go out and fight, that they weren't going to be just found in there. And she said, no, this is not a time for fighting. Let's pray together. At which point they kind of looked at her like she was crazy, but she insisted, and if you're ever around Carmen, she's a person with tremendous personal charisma. And so she had them all sit there, and she prayed for protection to God, at which point the National Guard left and did not come down through the roof. But numerous experiences where Christians were forced to make a decision about how they were going to react to the increasing turmoil engulfing Nicaragua. As I mentioned, the war was extremely brutal. This is a church where a number of people had taken refuge that then was bombed and machine gunned by the National Guard in León and has been left as a monument, a reminder to the brutality of the war. Well, by 1979, Nicaragua was essentially ungovernable by the Somoza regime anymore, and it was, in every sense of the word, a popular insurrection. The Sandinistas probably never numbered more than 6,000 guerrillas, as opposed to the 15 or 20,000 National Guardsmen. But what happened was that the broad sectors of the population participated in a national uprising that eventually expelled the Somoza dictatorship. And this is the day of the July 19th, 1979, when the triumph emerged and entered Managua and the ruins of the cathedral here. What has happened since then? In the first few years of the revolution, there was a tremendous euphoria throughout Nicaragua and a tremendous excitement and will to work to achieve all the things that people had been fighting for. One of the first things that happened here was the new government dedicated much of the revolution to the children in the revolution and said, it's for the future of the children that we have been fighting, therefore they will be one of the priorities of the revolution. And so on the ruins of downtown Managua, one of the very first things they did was build a park for the children. You can see the ruins of the cathedral and some of the office buildings in the background. One of the other important initial achievements of the revolution has been in healthcare. Healthcare was declared immediately, within a month of the triumph of the revolution, as not a privilege but a right to every Nicaraguan. Every Nicaraguan has a right to free healthcare. And so a whole grassroots system of putting into place education and healthcare centers throughout the country took place. And this took place with tremendous amounts of international aid, both with people coming to work in Nicaragua, but also sending medical supplies and technicians to set up a healthcare system. One of the particular emphasis has been on preventive health. And there have been vaccination campaigns that have eliminated polio. For example, polio still kills a number of people in some of Nicaragua's neighbors, such as Honduras, but it has been eliminated inside Nicaragua. And other communicable diseases have been severely reduced. They have vaccination campaigns that go in cycles of three, separated by 6 weeks. And what they have done is organize each neighborhood and each town. The people in each neighborhood or town then elect volunteer workers to work in healthcare. They then go to centrals of health care areas to get training in healthcare and then are responsible for carrying out the healthcare in their own areas. And by working with the local people in each area, they found this to be a very effective way to reach people. Part of the problem has been one of education as well, because they have centuries and centuries of people not being given access to modern healthcare, and so they've built up a whole mythology around healthcare and have had to learn the things such as basic hygiene. Another one of the important triumphs of the revolution, as they're called there, has been around literacy. When Nicaragua overthrew the government in 1979, illiteracy stood at 52%. So over half of all Nicaraguan adults could not read or write. The following year, they spent a year organizing a national literacy campaign that took place starting in August of 1980. And it mobilized thousands and thousands of high school age and young college age students to take 5 months to go out into the countryside and to teach the people to read and write. But not only did they teach reading and writing, these people went out, these young students went out and lived with the people, worked with them during the day, and gave literacy classes at night. One of the effects of this was to take thousands of young people who had never left the cities and make them aware, one, of the rural life in Nicaragua, but also the tremendous poverty in Nicaragua. And the literacy campaign had a tremendous galvanizing effect on the country as people began to see truly what the revolution was for in terms of the poor in Nicaragua. In 6 months, the illiteracy rate fell from 52% to 12%. And now, at this point, over 1 million of Nicaragua's 3 million people are involved in some form of ongoing education. Put up these posters here about the literacy campaign. It was not taught only in Spanish, but also in English and the Indian languages, such as Miskito and Suma. One of the things you see when you go to Nicaragua is that throughout the country now, people are working at reading and writing, and education has become a real prime one of the most important things in Nicaragua to the people there. Another of the areas has been around women's concerns, particularly child care and women's working rights, such that now women are all now guaranteed 6 weeks before and 6 weeks after birth, time off from their jobs with full pay. So they have a 3-month period there where they can take time off to give birth and tend to the new baby. Child care has started, although it's very, very limited because of their lack of resources, but there has been a whole organizing effort around the situation of women in Nicaragua to guarantee them rights. And one of the most exciting things is Nicaragua is in the process of writing its new constitution now, which is supposed to be presented in January of this coming year. And particularly around the situation of women, there has been a lot of input and work in guaranteeing equal rights for women in Nicaragua. Housing has been another area where there has been a lot of effort going on in spite of the lack of resources. The Sandinistas have devised what I think is a rather ingenious approach. They have set up neighborhoods by setting up the infrastructure, providing roads, providing electricity, providing water, and setting out the plots of land. They don't have the resources to build new homes for everyone. And so what they have done is take the people from the very poor slums and the contaminated areas and give them these plots of land and give them minimal resources and then let the people build on them. They call these progressive urbanization programs because the people then get resettled on them, and then as the people are able to gather their resources, they continue to work to rebuild their homes. And so you come to them and you see very spotty kinds of some homes that are fairly nice and new, and other homes where they simply brought the materials from before. But the idea is to get them in an area where they can have access to clean water, to electricity, and eventually to a nicer neighborhood, and let them work on that. The whole effort of the government's programs is to combine the initiative at the base level with the help from the government, so the people are doing much of the work themselves. One of the other things that the Sandinistas have done is defined 6 basic grains, such as rice, beans, cooking oil, so forth, that are available to all Nicaraguans at a fixed subsidized price, so that no one needs to go hungry. Now this has had mixed results. It worked very well in the first few years. In the last few years, when there have been food shortages, it hasn't worked well. And so they've had to decide how to revamp this system so that they can still guarantee that all Nicaraguans have access to basic food grains. Probably the most important thing, however, the Sandinistas have done has been the agrarian reform. Because Nicaragua is a rural country based on farming. And the vast majority of the people are campesinos, are people of the land, who have never had access to the land, at least in the last century, have been expelled from that. And so there has been an extensive land reform system set up to allow campesinos to have access to the land. One of the things that happened in Nicaragua has an abundance of land. It actually is a country that's probably underpopulated for the amount of national territory it has, but it was the distribution of the land that kept most people from having access to it. And when the Somoza family left Nicaragua, over 20% of the land suddenly became state-owned land because it had been privately owned by the Somoza family. And so they were able to take much of this land and turn it into cooperatives, into state farms, and give it over to individual farmers. This is typical of the cooperatives that have been set up. It's a very moving experience to talk with people who have never had access to land but have spent their lives working on the land, and they would inevitably run and show you the land title that they have that proves that they are now owners of this land. In 1984, the government held elections in Nicaragua. There were 11 political parties, of which 7 participated. Three or four, depending on how you define them, decided to boycott the elections and did not participate, but the other 7 did. The Sandinista Party emerged with about a little over 63-64% of the vote, and therefore has the presidency, the vice presidency, and the majority in the National Assembly. The last part I want to talk a little bit about was just the response of Christians to this. And if you follow some of the earlier talks in the week with the different sectors within the church, of a traditional church, a more reform-minded church, and then a church of the poor born out of working to change the situation, You can imagine the response follows very similar to these lines. The base communities throughout Nicaragua, in the rural areas and in the cities, have enthusiastically supported much of what has happened in the revolutionary process. And you can understand why. These are the people who are benefiting directly from the programs, such as the land reform, the health care, the education systems being put into place. This is a delegate of the Word, one of the lay leaders in northern Nicaragua who has started a number of the base communities and works in that area. He and his family are also campesinos who for the first time now have land that they can work on. But there have been other people as well. It's not only the poor who have responded. There have been a number of middle class and wealthy Christians who began to see that what was happening in Nicaragua under the Somoza regime was causing tremendous suffering and have decided to work with the revolutionary process in hopes that it can improve the lives of Nicaraguans, even while realizing that many of the privileges that they have enjoyed they will have to give up. This is Carmen, the woman I mentioned to you before, who told us that had to set up her house. And this is inside a bomb shelter that she has built in the back of the yard. Many people in Nicaragua have built bomb shelters since 2 years ago when the United States threatened to bomb Nicaragua if the Soviet MiGs were found there. But Carmen is representative of a wealthy Christian who has decided to work with the revolution. One of the things she has done is work in the cultural aspects, and they have a lot of street theater that they use to express their faith and festival days. There are also three priests who are represented at the national level in the government. Ernesto Cardinal is the priest on the right, in the white, and the fellow on the left is Miguel Descoto. Ernesto Cardinal is the Minister of Culture. Miguel Descoto is a Marinal priest and is the Minister of Foreign Relations, essentially the equivalent of our Secretary of State. And there has been a lot of tension with the Vatican and also with the bishops in Nicaragua over the fact that some of these priests have decided to work within the government. But Christians are represented through every level within the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. Now, while there has been a large number of people who have supported what is going on, there are large sectors of the church that are either concerned or outright opposed to the Sandinista government and the programs. And they have centered primarily around one man who is shown here. His name is Miguel Obando y Bravo, Cardinal. He is the Archbishop of Managua, and a year ago was made a cardinal by the Vatican. There are 9 bishops in Nicaragua, and he is the president of the Bishops' Conference. He is a man who initially, towards the end of the Somoza dictatorship, began to speak out against Somoza, and so it was through his support to the Sandinistas. But since 1979, there has been a growing rift between the Sandinista government and the church hierarchy, headed by Cardinal Obando y Bravo. He now celebrates Mass in a church outside of Managua a ways, because there is no more cathedral there. But it has become a rallying point for especially the sectors of the upper class who are alarmed at what is happening in the government and now come here to worship and also have rallied around him as a political opposition figure. To give you an idea, it's the only church I've ever seen in Nicaragua where there was a traffic jam outside, because most people don't have cars. But in this particular case, a lot of people come from all over who are among the wealthy and the powerful, and this is where they worship. But he also has a tremendous following among many poor people in Nicaragua who have a real reverence for the bishops and the church hierarchy. There have also been some opposition political parties that are very angry at what the Sandinistas are doing and feel the Sandinistas are trying to form a one-party state that will exclude them. And so some of these are parties that boycotted the elections in 1984. Another area of controversy, it has been censorship of the press that has taken place off and on in Nicaragua since 1982, when the first state of emergency was declared after the initial attack by the Contras blew up bridges in northern Nicaragua. And this was the mural, it's called the mural of censorship that La Prensa had, showing the articles that had been censored each day from their newspaper by the government. La Prensa has also been closed now in the last 2 months. Following the vote for the $100 million in aid to the Contras, La Prensa was closed by the Sandinistas. And so there are many people who are opposed to this. There has been a difficulty in the last few years with the economic situation in Nicaragua, and tremendous shortages, such as Coca-Cola here, which is sort of a national drink there, but also shortages of basic goods in the marketplaces, and there has been inflation. The resulting from probably a combination of three factors. One has been the U.S. blockade of Nicaragua that has cost Nicaragua hundreds of millions of dollars. Secondly, has been probably most importantly, has been the whole war situation, which is consuming about half of Nicaragua's national budget. There's simply the defense has become the priority spending at the expense of things such as consumer goods. And also has been economic mishandling of the situation. The Sandinistas are trying a lot of innovative new programs, such as I mentioned before, the subsidizing of basic grains. And sometimes these have backfired on them and aggravated their situation rather than helped it. But the result is that there have been sectors of society that are very unhappy with this, and particularly sectors within the church, and are therefore opposed to the Sandinista government. Probably the most polarizing situation in Nicaragua, however, is the war. And this is particularly so within the church. The war is consuming, as I mentioned, over half of Nicaragua's national budget. And in the last 2 years, there has been a mandatory draft for all men aged 16 to 27, I think it is. And this has caused a tremendous amount of turmoil within society, and particularly within the church. The church hierarchy officially opposes the draft and has counseled numerous young men to refuse to serve in the army. And the Sandinistas are very angry at this and see this as a political move on the part of the church, and therefore there has been an escalation in the tensions between the two. But there have been over 12,000 Nicaraguans killed since the Contras first began fighting against the Sandinistas in about 4 years ago. And this has really split the country in many ways. Just a word about the Contra War, and then we'll open up for some discussion and questions. The strategy of the Contras, they're a small, relative to the Sandinista army, a fairly small, somewhere between 10 and 12,000, some people say up to 15,000, formed around a remnant of Somoza's National Guard that fled into Honduras following the war in 1979. Their targeting has been primarily economic targets, such as the bridge here that served the northern part of the country. But they also have been targeting specifically the most successful areas of the revolution, trying to encourage dissent and discouragement with the revolution. And this is a map here, which I see is in backwards, but still shows you. This represents about one-tenth of the national territory. It's the region of encompassing Matagalpa. And all of the areas you see highlighted at the dots are either healthcare centers or healthcare posts, which have been destroyed or blown up by the Contra attacks. The primary targets of the Contras when they come into rural communities are anyone that is perceived as cooperating with the Sandinista government. And so this usually includes healthcare workers, educational workers, and people involved in the church who are involved in organizing. This was a school that was burned by the Contras in an attack on a small town, and has the poster of the which says literacy is liberation, is what the literacy poster says here. But hundreds of lay people involved in education and healthcare have been killed in these attacks. It's a cooperative. I visited northern Nicaragua where a year and a half ago the Contras came in, and they waited until the men had gone out to the fields and then came into the cooperative, was being defended by a few women at that point, and burned and destroyed the school and killed six of the people in the cooperative. When we came there 10 months later, the people were rebuilding the school, and so this is the new school that's being rebuilt on the site. This is a classmate of, or a memory, a memorial plaque for a classmate of mine who I studied with in Costa Rica, who was a pastor working with Christians in northern Nicaragua, working very much with the programs of the revolution. And he was targeted and killed by the Contras a couple years ago because of his work in those programs. The North American nun simply holding the map showing the areas of the country that her particular order has projects that have been destroyed by the counter-revolutionary Tecumseh. And I point this fellow up here. This is Father Jim Phelps, who is a North American missionary who has a parish church in the central part of the country in the very mountainous part that has been particularly hard hit by the counter-revolution. And he has had over 300 members of his parish killed by the Tecumseh. He himself was kidnapped by the Tecumseh for a period of time, threatened with death if he did not discourage the participation of his church workers in the revolutionary programs, and released. But and he lives in an area that has been brutalized by the Nicaraguan Tecumseh. The Tecumseh tend to be too small to attack the Sandinista army directly, and so they make a lot of hit-and-running attacks on the civilian population. This has created vast numbers of displaced people, hundreds of thousands of people who have been seen their lives uprooted by the war, much as we saw in El Salvador last night. And has also created a situation where the mourning for people goes on and on. This was a little 8-year-old girl that was killed in a town I happened to visit the following day. And her parents came and asked me to take a picture of her because she had been killed in crossfire, but they had never had a photograph taken of her while she was alive. So this is the only photograph they now have. The people in the same town, this is a group of mothers who 11 of their sons were killed when the Tecumsehs came through and pulled them out of their homes and assassinated them. But the effect of this has been to traumatize the country. And it has polarized the church tremendously. The base levels of the church, the grassroots communities, are very angry and upset, and many of them are the people who are being killed by this and want very much to denounce this, both the U.S. support for this and the Tecumseh activities. The controversy has come in that the Catholic Church has refused to condemn these events, the church hierarchy. Instead, it is calling for negotiations between the Tecumsehs and the Sandinistas. And it has been the refusal of the church to condemn these attacks that has created the tension between the church and the government and between the different sectors of the church in Nicaragua. I'll close simply with a story of a family that I've become quite close with in northern Nicaragua that I've visited a number of times. And this is where one of the daughters is buried on the cooperative. This is the family of Florentina, the woman in the center, with her mother on the left and her youngest daughter, Concepcion, on the right. I think the story kind of encapsulates what is happening in Nicaragua and why the country has experienced such turmoil. In the attack on the cooperative I mentioned a while back that took place a year and a half ago, Florentina's daughter, who was a victim of polio, who was crippled but happened to be in the cooperative that day, was killed trying to defend the cooperative. And her husband was killed nearby in the fields. And so the Concepcion's father and sister were both killed that day. When I happened to visit this cooperative, this is at the site here actually where her daughter, Maria Sunilda, was killed. I happened to visit this cooperative in October of last fall. And Concepcion and I hit it off really well. We spent a lot of time together. She's just a delightful little girl, very cheerful. I wondered a lot what the effects were for her of having had her sister and her father killed by the counter-revolutionaries. Her mother at one point looked at me and she said, "I think I know why Concepcion is so fond of you. You remind her of her godfather, who was a Swiss man named Mauricio, who was a Swiss agricultural technician working in that area. He was a Roman Catholic working with the Brothers of Charity and have been assigned to work in Nicaragua for 3 years. And had become extremely beloved by the people in this area. And when Concepcion, he had been named Concepcion's godfather, and particularly since the death of her own father, she had become very close to him. In February, Mauricio was driving a truck with a number of women and children back from a town into a rural area. The women had been advised that the Conchas were nearby and that they should wait until morning, but many of them were anxious about their families and wanted to get back. So Mauricio volunteered to drive them back through to their villages. The truck hit a landmine that the Tecumsehs had laid and then was ambushed and machine gunned by the Tecumsehs afterwards, which killed Mauricio and six of the women and one of the children. And for me, this is especially poignant because I've heard so many things about Mauricio before, and he was a man who really embodied the spirit of nonviolence and working with the poor. And the fact that he was driving these women back that day, I think, was typical of the way he lived and then also died. But it also made me think a lot about Concepcion and what it will be like for the children in this country who are growing up with so much violence being perpetrated against their families. And I remember Concepcion asked me when I was there, the people are very aware of who supports the Contras. And one of the most humbling things about being in Nicaragua is the warmth that the people accept you and welcome you with, even though they know that our government is the one that funds the Contras against them. And Concepcion asked me at one point, she just simply said, why did your government have to send arms to kill my sister and my father? And of course, I didn't know what to say to her at that point. And I can imagine the next time I go back to see Concepcion, you know, now that her godfather, Mauricio, has been killed by the same arms, what it will be like to try and respond to her. But I hope that what this will do is give you some idea of the kind of tensions within the church in Nicaragua. It is a situation where the church has become very polarized because the poor tend to be the ones who are suffering very much, and yet they have taken such an active response in the church that they will no longer be quiet and submissive. The hierarchy, while there's diversity within the hierarchy, the head of the hierarchy, Cardinal Ovando Bravo, is very much opposed to the Sandinistas. And this has created the tensions from the society have transferred themselves into the church as well. And so there is a lot of polarization going on within the church in Nicaragua. Finally, we find some lights and take some time for some questions. Okay, I want to go to Don and the hand over here. I'll start with Don.
I really appreciate all that you shared with us. And so much we learned here that we have not learned before. One thing I have learned before, which I would like to know what your opinion on is, and that is we hear in the press that there was also a bloodbath when this revolution was and many people killed. We also hear that the Mestizo Indians are even at this day being persecuted. And I hear that from American Indian people in my state that are some of the poorest in America. Who have been convinced that even visited there, the Mosquito Indians are being persecuted. What do they have to do?
Okay, so very good question. I will have to say at the beginning that I am not an unbiased, objective observer. I am unabashedly on the side of the people who have been suffering in Nicaragua. That does not translate immediately into support for the Sandinistas, but I think many of the Sandinista programs have benefited the poor. One of the areas. This is a rough sketch of Nicaragua here, the lakes here, Managua sits about here. The Mosquito Indians are found primarily in here. A couple things. I think there has been a tremendous amount of disinformation, and by that I mean deliberate misinformation in our press that has been planted by the Reagan administration, because the Reagan administration has made a decision that it cannot live with the Sandinistas. And so while it talks a lot about negotiating and supporting Contadora, its actions simply do not indicate that. It is out to overthrow the Sandinistas. And so the kinds of information we get are full of half-truths. There is a lot of truth in what's being said, but it's not the full story. As far as a bloodbath after the revolution, I think that is patently false. One of the things that happened right away after the revolution was the first thing the Sandinistas did was declare outlaw the death penalty. So there is no death penalty in Nicaragua. The maximum prison sentence you can get is 30 years. If you look at the revolutions that took place in 1979, there were three major ones going on: Nicaragua, Iran, and Uganda. I think probably most of us are familiar with what has happened in Uganda and what has happened in Iran since then, just tremendous bloodbaths. But that has not happened in Nicaragua. That's not to say there haven't been problems, there haven't been persecutions, there haven't been a polarized society, but there wasn't a bloodbath that took place. Now, as far as the Mosquito Indians, that is probably one of the areas where the Sandinistas have made their most serious mistakes. In the 2 years after following the revolution, I mentioned that Nicaragua is essentially like two countries. The East Coast was colonized by Britain, so it had a very different culture. It's primarily, the primary religion there is among the Moravian Church, not the Catholic Church. It's English-speaking and Mosquito-speaking. It traditionally has had very little to do with the Pacific coast or the Spanish-speaking coast. And Somoza, by and large, left the Atlantic coast alone. he opened it up for a tremendous amount of multinational exploitation. So a lot of mining, timber companies came in and used the mineral resources there, but there wasn't a very repressive kind of government structure present. Following the 1979 revolution, I mentioned that the next few years were marked by a kind of euphoria. And if, when Daniel Ortega was asked what was the major mistake of the revolution in the early years, he said, we tried to do too much. We tried to do everything in the first couple years. One of the things that happened was that the government tried to extend the revolution over into the Atlantic coast, and the people over here didn't want it. The revolution had taken place all on the Pacific coast, and the people there had several decades of organizing, of thinking through and everything else, and knew what they were fighting for. The Miskitos, the people on the Atlantic coast, had never even heard of it. And all of a sudden, historically much suspicion from the Atlantic coast towards anybody who comes from the Pacific coast. They call them the Spanish. They don't even call them Nicaraguans, they call them the Spanish. And so all of a sudden, hordes of these young people were coming over and telling him, you need to learn to read and write, and you're now part of the revolution, and we've liberated you. And that we liberated us from what? And so there was a lot of miscommunication. A lot of the people who were sent over there had no idea where they were going, and there were a lot of abuses that went on. And the Sandinistas probably, in 2 years, created enough resentment and ill feeling that it'll take them the next 20 or 30 to undo. Now, I take most of my understanding of what has happened on the Atlantic coast. I've visited there a couple times. I know people who live in Managua who are from there. And it also comes from the human rights organizations such as Amnesty International, America's Watch, and Washington Office on Latin America. According to those organizations, they have documented about 75 deaths caused by the Sandinistas, killings by the Sandinistas against the Miskitos, and another 75 or so disappearances. So there have been a number of grave human rights violations by the Sandinistas against the Atlantic coast, especially in the first, from 1979 to 1981 or so. Now, I don't want to minimize that, but I think there's a fair amount of hypocrisy on the administration's part pulling those up. And part of why I will say that is, for example, if you look at the situation of Guatemala, one of Nicaragua's neighbors, during the same period that these violations occurred, the Guatemalan government is documented as having killed between 36,000 and 72,000 Indians. It is literally committing genocide against the Indians there. This does not affect our opinion of this, but when President Reagan was asked personally about the situation of human rights violations in Guatemala, and I quote, he said, I think Guatemala is getting a bum rap in the press. So I'm surprised at President Reagan's tremendous concern over the Miskitos, but total lack of concern over the Indians in Guatemala. And I think it has more to do with the fact that he is trying to paint a picture of Nicaragua that's so unpalatable to the United States that will justify the actions he wants to do to get rid of the Sandinistas. Kind of a long response to your question, but I think that the charges, by and large, are unjustified that we hear in the press.
Has our unwillingness to deal with Ortega pushed him into the Russian camp?
Well, if I have any fear about what's happening in Nicaragua, what I'm afraid of, and I think that this is the strategy in many parts of the United States, I think the strategy is to have this conflict go on for years and years and years and essentially bleed the country to death. I think the Reagan administration knows that the U.S. population is not going to support a military intervention unless he can build a very good case for it. But in the meantime, he can continue to control and support the Contras, continue to prevent the Sandinista government from doing the programs they want, and bleed this country. The result of that has been that the Sandinistas have looked elsewhere for their aid. And while the majority of their economic aid comes from Western Europe and the rest of Latin America, the vast majority of their military aid comes from the Soviet bloc now. And I think that the danger is that there will be a dependency created there. They have remained adamant publicly when they talk about they want to be an independent sovereign nation. They do not want to trade one colonizer, the United States, for another, the Soviet Union. But I think that one of the realities is the longer you create a situation where they're militarily dependent, the more you support the hardline factions that would like that kind of alliance, and you weaken the moderates who don't. So at this point, I don't think Nicaragua is a Soviet colony. But I think there's the danger in the long run that we will push them into that camp and not give them the opportunity to be independent.
what is the basis of a Bando Bravo's being against the 70s conflict with the 70s?
I think that,
I didn't hear the question.
I'm sorry, the question was, what is the basis of Cardinal Obando y Bravo's being against, or his opposition to the Sandinistas? I think he has a genuine fear that the Sandinistas will try to create a one-party state, they will try to create a Marxist government, at which the church will suffer as a result of that. I think, historically, Obando y Bravo has been very closely aligned with more of the business class and more conservative sectors. And while he began to oppose the Somoza regime about the same time that the business class began to oppose the Somoza regime, Obando y Bravo would like to see, he's somewhere in between the conservative sector and the reform-minded sector of the church. What he has stated is that he would like for Nicaragua would be a government much like Costa Rica, which is the next country south, which has a more of a traditional Western-style democracy with elections every 4 years and a national assembly and so forth, that a reform-oriented government rather than a revolutionary government. And I think he is genuinely concerned about the polarization within Nicaragua and is afraid about the consequences that might come. I also think that he represents a church that traditionally has had a very powerful voice in what's happening in Nicaragua and is seeing the potential anyway for that dissipating. So I think there are a lot of things going on there, but basically I think it's a difference in philosophy and in what they would like to see happen for Nicaragua. Here and then back there.
You've certainly stirred a slumbering concern in me in your talk this week. What suggestion would you make to this old white Protestant about translating this into something useful?
I think there are a number of different things that we can do. For me, the connection between Christians is really important to me, and I think that our churches, just simply being sister and brother churches, the churches there have a response to listen to Nicaraguan Christians in what they're saying, or El Salvador, Guatemala, wherever in Central America. So I think one of the most important things we can do is continue to educate ourselves and see what is happening. If any of the things I'm saying to you are surprising and new, it may be because the news sources that we depend on don't print all of what's happening there. And I'll just give an example of that. When I was there, two things happened the same day I was there. A truck carrying 32 civilians was ambushed and destroyed by the Contras, killing 12 children, 12 women, and 7 men. The one driver escaped, severely wounded. The same day, one of the bishops was expelled from the country. When I came back to the United States and looked back at the newspapers at that time, there was widespread coverage over the bishop's expulsion, and I could not find anywhere mentioned that this truck had hit a landmine. Now, it's coincidental that the landmine was a U.S. mine and was put by U.S.-supported people there, but we're getting part of the story, not all of the story, and I think it's important that we educate ourselves to get the full story so that we can decide more. I think there are ways that, financially, there are a number of projects that we could be supporting that help people, such as the healthcare and the education project, that go through. They don't have to go through Sandinista channels. There are a number of different organizations, such as CEPAD, which is a Protestant relief and development agency, that directly benefit people. But when we ask Nicaraguans or Salvadorans the same question, they say the main thing that we need is to be able to develop and our revolution in peace, to be able to develop ourselves. And we can't do that as long as your government is sending the military aid to these people. So I think that the most important thing that we can do is get involved in changing public policy, whether that's writing letters, whether that is visiting the countries themselves and coming back and speaking with your representatives, working through your churches, whatever. There are a lot of different avenues, but it's basically, I think, to hear the Christians there and respond by affecting what we're doing here. People oftentimes ask me about the Sandinistas, and I have reservations about the Sandinistas. I think there are some things that we're legitimately concerned about. But my point is that as a North American, as a U.S. citizen, I have much more to say about my country's policies than I do about Nicaragua's policies within there. And given the history of U.S. intervention in the region, what's paramount for me is slowing down, at least, if not preventing, further U.S. intervention. I think we've got the lunch bell here, so I'll leave it at that. I'd be glad to talk with anybody privately.